Now to the second book of Samuel, chapter 1 and verse 17. 2 Samuel, chapter 1, verse 17. And David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan, his son. And we've been looking at the spiritual lessons from the lives of Saul and of David, though now we will be focusing entirely upon David. And remembering that the history of David and of Saul, indeed, is preserved here for us in New Testament times and for our learning. So we're not just interested in Old Testament history, we're interested in its spiritual message and the point which is made in event after event, things that are profitable for us. Now, in our last study, we closed with just touching on this lamentation for Saul, who had taken his life, and we look here to note one or two things fairly rapidly, as I'm keen that we should move on. But we looked at verse 18. Also, he bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow, which I'm sure it's right to take literally, though nowadays it's popular to assume that the term there, the bow, is the name of the lamentation or its tune. But I think undoubtedly it is that the children of Judah were to be taught the use of the bow. And we went into the application of that and the reasons for that. But the lamentation itself begins in verse 19. The beauty of Israel is slain upon thy high places. How are the mighty fallen? Very familiar words. Well, Jonathan is no doubt in view most of all. David's very close and particular friend, Jonathan, son of Saul, who had been due to be king in the place of his father, obviously, but he knew that David had been anointed, and being a man of faith, he yielded to David, protected him from the violence of his father, and they had a bond and a covenant between them. And it's no doubt Jonathan who's most in view, but also Saul, because we mustn't forget, though we may be surprised at some of the sentiments uttered by David in favour of Saul, we must remember that for the first half to two-thirds of his reign, he'd been a very noble defender of Israel. I'm sure he was never a spiritual man. He does not come through in the record at all as a regenerate man. And yet for the first portion, if not for most of his reign, he was a very valiant and vigilant defender of Israel. And so it's that side of his life that David prefers to look at and remind the people of, not his great mistakes that caused God to reject him and to take the kingdom in time away from him, not his increasing violence against David. And this is one of the finer points of David's character, that he can utter this lamentation without any acrimony, any bitterness against Saul, but thinks only of his more valiant period, a noble period. And so that's what he means when he refers in verse 19 to the beauty of Israel. And the 20th verse, tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ascalon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice. And that is a principle for us in all times. There certainly are great defeats for the people of God. In this case, their great defeat was due to the unspirituality of the king, and he brought it upon them. And their increasing misfortunes and vulnerability to the Philistines. But nevertheless, there are misfortunes, and when people are dead, when people are gone, we do not rake them up, we do not go over them. We say as little as possible. We certainly don't say things that would shame the gospel of Christ or the work of Christ before the unconverted and might discredit the gospel. Why, there was an example of this even in the history of our own church. because after the death of C.H. Spurgeon, there was quite a dispute about who would succeed him. Now, that dispute would have been handled very peaceably and perfectly, I'm sure, but there were one or two people who claimed to be members of the church, this is going back a long way, who broke ranks and wrote their opinions to the press. Well, that was a scandal. That was a wrong thing. And so the press called it the Tabernacle Tempest. And you must remember that the Tabernacle was huge in those days and was watched very closely by society in general. And so it was a shameful and a wrong thing. And if there are disputes among us, and that was a dispute that was soon over and didn't last, nevertheless, we don't publish these things or gossip them or display them towards the unconverted. Of course we don't. And this principle stands here, even for the New Testament church. And we remember it. Tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ascalon, lest it brings the gospel and the Lord into disrepute before those who don't understand our affairs. Now, verse 21, ye mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, neither let there be rain. This is not a literal curse, you understand. In poetry, what David is expressing in this lament is a simple fact. Well, most of that generation, and for some generations afterwards, they wouldn't be able to look upon those beautiful scenes there down in the hills of Gilboa without regret. It wouldn't be a beautiful place because of its sad memories. Well, that's natural enough. It would remind them of a very disappointing and crushing period of their history. And then in verse 22, from the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan, who was a great archer, turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Well, the sword of Saul certainly did return empty in latter days, but not for the most of his reign. And so David very graciously remembers that in his lament. And verse 23, Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives. Again, always true of Jonathan, true of Saul earlier on, even as an unregenerate man. In his earlier life, he knew how to be gracious, and this would have been true. And in their death, they were not divided. There was no breach between father and son. They were swifter than eagles, stronger than lions. Not descriptions of them personally, but in their better times, of their attitudes. Swift to defend the realm, strong in their organization of those defenses. And then the public memory is very short. And in verse 24, ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet, with other delights, who put on or put on you ornaments of gold upon your apparel. Well, allowing for poetic speech, remember, women folk, says the lamentation, that you've got things in your cupboards and in your homes that are precious and valuable, and it all came from the great prosperity and success that attended the most part of the reign of Saul. Don't forget it, because of the difficulties of later times. And then verse 25, how are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? O Jonathan, thou wast slain in high places. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. And this 26th verse seems to have caused a lot of debate, and it's strange that it should. It's the last sentiment in the verse. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. As though the focus is that Jonathan had a capacity to love and to be loyal and to be kind to David far beyond his wives or any woman. Well, in fact, the sentiment is a compliment to women. When David thinks of Jonathan and his unselfish attitude, as soon as he knew that David was anointed, He stood aside. He did not stand in his way, and he lent him all his support and help. Well, says David, in effect, that kind of unselfishness you associate with womanhood, with women. And here is Jonathan exhibiting that. So, in fact, it is a compliment. It isn't really a statement of comparison or intended to be such. And verse 27, how are the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished? And that is a most profound spiritual statement. In a sense, it's a statement of the obvious. There is Saul, at one time so powerful, so big, so tall, so effective in his work as in his reign. And there is Jonathan, really an amazing character, a man of great stature in every sense, brilliant at what they did in the defense of Israel and Judah. Yet they've gone. It collapsed. It didn't work out. Saul failed morally and in character. In every way. Jonathan didn't appear to fail in that way, but they were all defeated in the end by the Philistines. Well, what's profound about that? It comes on the end of a lamentation, and it reminds us, however great, however worthy, sometimes the Church of Jesus Christ may be viewed, well, just materially, rationally. It may be that at some times in our history, we have some truly great men. Spurgeon was a genius, no question about it. The more you read his sermons, occasionally you'll come across a disappointing one, but most of the time, they are just so amazing, so astonishing. The man was a genius in every way. The Apostle Paul, naturally even more so, you would think was a genius. The more you read Calvin and his grasp of theology and affairs and his penetrating comments, we have had people of genius proportions, but they pass. It all goes. They were noble people, but how are the mighty fallen and the weapons of war that they wielded perished? At the end of the day, we depend upon the Spirit of God. We depend upon the Lord to supply those people. And if he is not supplying people of that magnificent stature, then by the power of the same Spirit to equally bless lesser people, it is the Lord we trust in. So I'm not in favor of those people who love to write biography only of the great ones. And then they say, this is what we need. This kind of verse reminds us, how are the mighty fallen? It's the Spirit of God. It's the spiritual aspects of the battle that we should focus on most of all. Well, I come into chapter 2, and it came to pass after this that David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah? He's still in semi-ruined Ziklag, and he asks guidance from God. And so do we. Of course, he received it in a very direct manner. The Lord said, go up, and David said, whither shall I go up? And he said, unto Hebron. Well, it's not so easy for us. We are to seek the guidance of the Lord, but we're not going to get a direct and immediate message. Some people look for that, and that's foolish. Some people don't seek guidance at all on anything, and that has become fashionable among Christians. But we have to seek guidance and place ourselves at the Lord's disposal and clear away the obstacles of our own desire that might skew our outlook and pray for good reasoning power to weigh the pros and cons of the decision before us and bear in mind all the biblical principles and pray that God will help us but make ourselves available to him in everything. Now, it's becoming popular even among Christians. No, make your own decisions. Make your own career. Decide for yourself. Well, that's not the way we're taught in the Scripture. But God guides, and he's told to go to Hebron, and he took all his people and his wives and the men who were with him there. And in verse 4, the men of Judah came to Hebron and they anointed David king. That's his formal coronation, as it were, at least as far as Judah is concerned. And then the first setback, verse 4, they told David, saying that the men of Jabesh-Gilead were they that buried Saul. And David sent messengers to them, and he complimented them. And, he gave him his best wishes for having done a noble and a kind and a good thing. And then he drops the hint to them in verse 7. Now, your master Saul is dead, and also the house of Judah have anointed me king over them. And that's really an invitation to Jabesh-Gilead to say, it's time for you to follow suit. David is going to proceed by courtesy, not by conquest. And then one of the great buts of the Bible in verse 8, but Abner, the son of Ner, captain of Saul's host, took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim and made him king over what was left, at any rate, of the cities of Israel. Abner was Saul's uncle, and he took Saul's fourth surviving son and made him king over Israel. In verse 9, it's called all Israel, which is, you need to kind of put that in inverted commas, because a lot of Israel was actually occupied by the Philistines at the time. Israel's portion of the land was in pretty poor shape. And then you get some statistics which people constantly ask for an explanation of. So let's just look at them. Verse 10, Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel and reigned 2 years. But the house of Judah followed David. And the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. So if David had only Judah for 7.5 years, whereas Ishbosheth ruled Israel in the north for only 2 years, what happened for the other 5.5 years? Well, it is a puzzle, because from the narrative here, the impression is given that Ishbosheth was brought into reign by Abner straight away. And yet also other passages, which we'll come to, tell us almost the other way round, that it was the final assassination of Ishbosheth that marked David having both parts of the kingdom, Judah and Israel. So what is going on? And the construction, the correct construction, is something like this: that Abner made Ishbosheth king over Israel pretty well straight away. So in a sense, he ruled for the whole 7.5 years. But Israel was in such a bad state, and Ishbosheth was parked across to the east of the Jordan in Mahanaim, where he'd be safe, and Abner was the strong man, and he really ruled, even though Ishbosheth, the fourth and surviving son of Saul, was the nominal king of that part. And Abner set about, and it took a long time to do it, clearing out the Philistines. He never entirely did it, but he largely did it. And he cleared the Israelite territory. And we assume that after about 5 years, when he'd sufficiently accomplished that, then they made a formal coronation for Ishbosheth, and he reigned for the last 2 of the 7.5 years in a credible and a proper manner over Israel. He was there the whole time, but Abner was the strong man clearing up the territory and chasing out the Israelites. And that's the best construction we can put on it, because Scripture never contradicts itself. So all the statements must be right. The period overall was 7.5 years that the kingdoms were divided. Ishbosheth was there at the beginning and at the end, and yet he only reigned for 2 years of them. So that's the best explanation, relating the passages together, one to another. Well, dear friends, there was conflict from verse 12 of chapter 2. And Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. And now Abner is obviously making trouble. One man stands in the way of David having the whole kingdom, and that is Abner. One man, you could say, frustrates the whole plan, the whole endeavor. And that's how it sometimes is, isn't it? In the world, certainly, and sometimes even in churches. How sad when one person can obstruct the work of a church. Sometimes I have to say it's the pastor. I know situations, and you won't know what I'm referring to, I'm sure, but I know situations where it is a pastor who's been the hindrance, and the people in the church have wanted to bring the children in from all the blocks of flats around and have a growing Sunday school and get ahead with the work, and the pastor didn't want it. And that went on for years, and the whole church was semi-paralyzed because of the indolence of a pastor. So sometimes it can be some strong, powerful personality within the church. Well, it's a very sad thing. In this case, it was the whole nation. It was Abner, ambitious, powerful, strong personality, who wanted the control of Israel. And so he had the weak Ishbosheth as his puppet king. And then he started to make trouble. So that's in verse 12, make trouble even for Judah. So there's this account, and I read chapter 2, verse 13. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met together by the pool of Gibeon. 70-by-40-foot pool, fed by a spring, a powerful spring, in the valley below Gibeon town. And they assembled, says they sat down, the one on the one side of the pool and the other on the other side of the pool. There's a very strange translation in our version in verse 14. And Abner said to Joab, let the young men now arise and play before us. And Joab said, let them arise. And what is clearly going on is that the young men, and there's going to be 12 from each side, are acting as champions, rather as David and Goliath. But in this case, there are 12 on each side, and they are going to fight. And that's, the word play is rather interesting, but it's something much more serious than that. These two teams are going to engage in battle, rather than the whole forces of Judah and Israel. Actually, the forces don't seem very big in this conflict because the number of casualties, once they do get down to fighting, is so small that they must be fielding very small forces here. But then in verse 15, we read of how it was set up. And verse 16, they caught every one his fellow by the head, and thrust his sword, which would be a very short sword, more like a dagger, in his fellow's side, and they all killed each other. Well, I'm sure many of you know the record. Some people say they caught their beards and dragged their heads toward them. They all employed very similar movements, but they went for each other, these youngsters, and they managed to destroy each other. They're both teams of 12 were destroyed. And so, as that didn't resolve the issue, battle started, verse 17. And there was a very sore battle that day. And Abner was beaten and the men of Israel before the servants of David. And David lost very few men, whereas Abner lost 360. But verse 18 is interesting. There were three sons of Zeruiah there, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. And Asahel was as light of foot as a wild roe, the youngest of the three. And we read, and you know the record, how Asahel pursued after Abner. And in going, he turned not to the right hand nor to the left from following Abner. And Abner, who was being pursued by this, we always imagine, much younger man, who was noted, renowned as an exceptional runner, So we tend to see him as tall and very slim and young and nothing like as powerful as Abner, even if much faster. He's set his mind on the pursuit and the capture or death of Abner. Well, he's determined. Nothing will cause him to swerve aside. He means well. That's Abner, he says. He is the cause of all the trouble in the kingdom. And this young man undoubtedly means well, and he has zeal, but he's rather foolish. It isn't quite like David and Goliath, this. David was the anointed of the Lord. David was anointed by God to be the defender of Israel. He knew he had a special unction upon him. And furthermore, he had the official commission of Saul. So David, as a young man, was by the power of God able to overcome Goliath. Here is a young man with no such stature as David, nor direct divine commission, and here he is pursuing Abner, a seasoned and a very powerful man. Abner warns him off. You're familiar with the record, I'm sure. Not once, but more than once. And then finally, as Asahel draws close to him with a back thrust of his spear, which may have been sharpened at its opposite end, Abner kills him, and just on the spot. Well, now, why does the record give such an elaborate account of this, the slaying of Abner's pursuer? Well, there's a lesson in everything. The young man was doing something rather foolish. He wouldn't be put off. He overestimated his power to deal with Abner, and he was no match for this wily, this very cunning and powerful man. We always hear, oh, the spear of Abner, which he was carrying, that he thrust backward, had no doubt been sharpened at its opposite end so that it could be stuck in the ground. But whether sharpened or not, that man was very powerful, and he could have inflicted a disastrous wound. But you get Asahels today. Young people who mean well, they do mean well, but they set themselves up for great tasks for the Lord before they should, and without preparation, and without authorization from their churches or anything of that kind. And this is particularly possible, but I won't stay with this long, in this internet age. So all over the world there are Christian people who have scarcely had time to learn anything, and they've set themselves up on the internet, on their websites and so on, as writers, theologians, teachers, preachers, passing their opinions on everybody and everything under the sun, commenting on this and that situation. And it's an Asahel situation. They're running before they can walk, and it's a great shame. It's a tremendous blessing to see the very youngest Christians, as soon as they can, engaging in witness and in Christian service, but not leaping ahead and becoming overnight preachers and teachers. Why, the Apostle Paul warns that nobody should be ordained to ministry who is a novice, who is a beginner, lest that person falls into the snare of the devil and pride. And that is what happens on a widespread scale. And you look at some of these websites, and it's the blind leading the blind, and often well-intending people appointed, they've never had any appointment from their church, from their congregation, from anything, just doing their own thing. And some of those people, you wonder if they do anything in their local churches, under supervision and proper guidance, whether they're involved in the service of the Lord, or whether they're just entirely on their own, self-appointed in every way. So there's a lesson even in this well-intending young man who got himself killed through sheer foolishness and over-ambition. Well, Abner, in verse 26 of chapter 2, and I must hurry forward, he calls for a truce for a ceasefire. He's being pursued. And Joab, who is David's general, lets him off the hook. He gives him his ceasefire. Verse 28, Joab blew a trumpet, and all the people stood still and pursued after Israel no more, neither fought they any more. What a tragedy. He should have arrested Abner. We can see it all with hindsight. This is a disaster that Abner was able to go on making trouble and keeping the kingdom divided. Joab's job, while he had him in that state, was to arrest him and bring him back, something of that sort. But he didn't. They all went home, and that was the end of it. And again, this is a negative thing, but how much we've seen in this country of that. Why, I often mention to you that our historic Protestant denominations in the 19th century were large and effective and sound. What destroyed them? How did they all decline so rapidly so that by the first quarter of the 20th century they were finished and liberal almost entirely? How was it? No discipline. Joab never arrested Abner. He let him go. And in one denomination after another, in come the liberals, deny the Bible, first of all the higher critics and so on, deny the doctrines of the Bible, the evangelical faith, and they're not thrown out. And nobody deals with them. And when Spurgeon raised his protest in 1887, well, there was a storm and fierce opposition to him. People who were even converted and good people, they couldn't see the point. Why divide up our denomination? It can't possibly be that bad. But it was that bad. One denomination after another made a conscious decision not to discipline heresy and error. And so that won the field and won the day. And you can see all these things foreshadowed in a way in these detailed records. They're for us. What a foolish thing that Abner was not arrested when he lost that battle. A great tragedy. And now you come on to chapter 3. Now there was long war between the house of Saul, that's Abner of course, his uncle, who was really the controlling person of Israel, and the house of David. But David waxed stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul waxed weaker and weaker. And then there is the sad record of David's extending his marriages and his wives. David starts to take wife after wife. Now, most of them are what has often been called noble marriages. They were certainly not noble, but they were marriages to noble families, and foreign families often, as David made treaties with certain important Israelite tribe leaders, and with even outside Israel, foreign nations. They were political marriages in some cases, but also, obviously, marriages out of lust, and it was tragic disobedience. We see some of the strengths of David, but we also see in this record, unadorned, some of the terrible weaknesses of David. And we'll come to that in just a moment. But here down in verse 6 of chapter 3, it came to pass, while there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, that Abner made himself strong for the house of Saul. And that means not only did he become very powerful because he was clearing out the Philistines from their regions, but it clearly means that he was lining himself up for the kingdom of Israel. He was fed up with Ishbosheth, this weak puppet king, and he was obviously working towards it himself. And there is a charge brought against Saul by King Ishbosheth. And Saul, verse 7, had a concubine whose name was Rizpah. And King Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone in unto my father's concubine?" Had he? Was he guilty, Abner, of this, or was he innocent? Well, it doesn't actually determine that issue in the record here, but the great likelihood seems to be that he was guilty, because it's so close to the comment in verse 6, Abner made himself strong for the house of Saul. And so it strongly implied part of his beginning to move maneuver for taking the kingdom was affecting some link with the royal household of Saul, perhaps to give himself extra legitimacy. Ishbosheth confronts him with this, and Abner is furious in his response, verse 8, and he's insulted, and he says to Ishbosheth, well, I am the person who has saved Israel against Judah, and I've shown kindness to the house of Saul, your father, and delivered this land. And you're charging me with a fault. He doesn't say he's not guilty. He's outraged that he can't do what he wants to do. And so he takes this decision that, verse 9, as the Lord hath sworn to David, even so I do to him. Which means, as the Lord has given to David the anointing and the kingdom, so I will give to David the whole of the land. Now, this is an insight into Abner, of course. He's an ungodly man. He knows that David has been anointed king. It doesn't matter to him. He doesn't see himself as opposing God in maintaining a separate kingdom of Israel, which he is the effective leader of. He's well aware of the fact that David is anointed, and now he even says it. Well, God has anointed him, so I'm going over to his side. Now he's enraged with Ishbosheth. So he's an unscrupulous individual, and that is actually what he does. Ishbosheth seems to think it's an empty threat, but it isn't. He goes to David with counselors, with others. He makes a negotiation. He says, in effect, in this chapter, I'm coming over to you. David and he make a pact together. What does David promise Abner? Abner says, I will give you Israel. And we're not told what David says he will give to Abner. Well, Joab thought he knew. When Joab, David's general, finds out that while he's been away fighting a skirmish somewhere, Abner has visited his king, David, king of Judah, and they've done a deal together, Joab clearly thinks that David, King David, has promised Abner the generalship, his job. I think that's what is in his mind, because Joab is furious and insolent with the king. And so I go straight down to further down in the chapter, verse 22 of chapter 3. And behold, the servants of David and Joab came from pursuing a troop and brought in a great spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he was gone in peace. When Joab and all the host that was with him were come, they told Joab, saying, Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and he hath sent him away, and he is gone in peace. Then Joab came to the king and said, what hast thou done? Behold, Abner came unto thee. Why is it that thou hast sent him away and he is quite gone? Thou knowest, Abner, that he came to deceive and to know thy going out and thy coming in. And so Joab, without telling King David, arranges to send to Abner to come back to Hebron, and there he murders him, he kills him. In Hebron, of course, Joab's claim is that Abner murdered his brother, which was true, though it wasn't so much murder, it was self-defense. He was being pursued by Joab's brother Asahel. He was about to attack him. And now, here is Abner in Hebron. Hebron was the capital of Judah at that time. Yes, but it was the place where David held court, but it also happens to have been a Levite city and a city of refuge. You couldn't kill anybody without a special trial in a city of refuge. And Joab takes the law into his own hand and murders Abner. What a tangle! I might say Abner deserves to lose his life. He's been nothing but a troublemaker. He's frustrated everything for years. 7 years he's been single-handedly the cause of the complete frustration of David taking the whole kingdom. He deserves to lose his life. He is a violent and an arrogant, a proud man. Oh, yes. But Joab had no right to take it, to assassinate him in that way in a city of refuge. Everything is wrong, always round. But under the superintendency of God, God allows it to happen. An evil man to be slain by an evil man. And now Ishbosheth, a weak puppet king of Israel, is going to lose his own life from two of his military captains. And they're evil men too. They think by assassinating the king, King Ishbosheth of Israel, they're going to bring the news to David and get paid for it. And David promptly executes them. And in the times, that was absolutely the right thing for him to do. But nevertheless, you see how evil men, actually, with God, allows them to do their deeds and brings his purposes to pass. So David is going to come to the throne. Now we've time just to look on at chapter 5. Then came all the tribes of Israel to David unto Hebron and spake, saying, Behold, we are thy bone and thy flesh. So now Israel wants to be under David. Ishbosheth has gone. The house of Saul is no more, apart from Mephibosheth. We'll come to him in a future study. And here, Abner, the strong man, has gone. And so the Israelites want to be under David. They bring themselves and they say, We are the same ethnic group as you are. We are the same family. Why didn't they think of that before? They've been rebels up to this time. And now they've remembered they're the same family. But you notice they're not very spiritual people. The Israelites were in a very bad way. They don't say, we are God's people. We are under the same rule of God. We have the same faith and order and so on. No, we're just your flesh and blood. It's a pretty weak approach. But then these are their arguments. Take us and receive us and rule over us. Verse 2. In time past you did a good job for us when Saul was king over us. You were the one who so often led the military in the early days of that and did so much for us. And the Lord, by the way, has anointed you to be our king, the people of Israel, and to be our defender. So now they're waking up. So all the elders of Israel came to the king, and David made a league with them in Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed him. And then statistics, David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. In Hebron, we've seen this before, 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem, when it was taken, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. Well, here's David. Verse 6, the king and his men went to Jerusalem unto the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, which spake unto David, saying, Except thou take away the blind and the lame, thou shalt not come in hither, thinking, David cannot come in hither. Why, Hebron wasn't a good enough place to rule Israel and Judah. It was too associated with Judah. Jerusalem was a much better place. It was powerfully fortified. It belonged, of course, to Judah and to Benjamin. But Benjamin had lost it to the Jebusites. They'd allowed them to dwell among them, and they'd out-reproduced them, and they'd taken possession of the city and its strong ramparts and its stronghold. So now they were in charge, and they had no right there. But David wanted Jerusalem. That was the place where he would go. And this is an intriguing verse, this sixth verse of chapter 5. The Jebusites say, "Except thou take away the blind and the lame." Well, the modern view, on the whole, in the commentaries, is to say that this is just sarcasm on the part of the Jebusites. They're saying, in effect, if we put our blind people and our lame people on the walls, you still won't be strong enough to take this city. But the older interpretation, indeed the old Jewish interpretation, let alone the most popular interpretation among Reformed, among Protestant commentators, used to be that the blind and the lame is simply a term for their idols. And that, it seems to me, makes much better sense. So in verse 6, "Unless, except you take away the blind and the lame," and the Jebusites call their idols the blind and the lame, because that's what David and the people of Judah and Israel called them, these idols, people who can't see, idols, statues, images that can't see and can't talk. And so the Jebusites say sarcastically, "All right, if you can succeed in taking away our gods," but you can't do that. Some of them are made of brass. They're on the top of the city walls. They're referred to in the verses following. This is an impregnable city. They're so confident. And you know, I'm sure, how David challenged some of his men to go up using either an aqueduct or a watercourse. A gutter, it's called in our King James Version. We're not absolutely sure what it was. And promises the captaincy of the military to whoever succeeds. And Joab is the one who takes this on and who succeeds. And he leads his men and gets them into the city, and they take it. And so in verse 9, David dwelt in the fort and called it the city of David. And David built round about from Millo and inward. And David went on and grew great, and the Lord of hosts was with him. And this terrible 13th verse of chapter 5, and we'll be drawing to conclusion. David took him more concubines and wives out of Jerusalem after he was come from Hebron, and there were yet sons and daughters to be born. David's sin. Well, it was against Genesis and the creation ordinance of God. One man, one woman to be married together. It was against the command to kings under Moses in our book of Deuteronomy. Neither shall he multiply wives unto himself. It was against the moral law. It was acting like the pagan nations around. It was often done with tactical intention to court a family or a nation. It was lawless, heartless, disloyal. It was pagan. But it is just amazing that there was divine toleration for David over that. And how do we explain that? Well, Israel was not only Judah, was not only a church, it was also a nation. And David was, on the whole, a man after God's own heart. And so, as their leader and the defender, God overlooked even his sins, and in time brought him to repentance over all his sins. But David didn't leave them unpunished. God, rather, didn't leave David's sins unpunished. And as we go on in the life, you see the terrible tragedies and pain and suffering and heartache that came to him through his family because of his polygamy, because of his many wives. So while God tolerated it to the point of leaving him in office, He certainly did not tolerate it in terms of the punishment he meted out to David in his personal life. Well, our time was out. I'm just going to read to the very end of this fifth chapter. There's a great battle. The Philistines make first one, then a second attempt to bring David's reign to a halt as early as they can. And on the first attempt, David seeks the guidance of the Lord, and the Lord says, go up against them, and you'll have victory over them, and David does that. But the second time, there's a difference. Verse 22 of chapter 5, the Philistines came up yet again and spread themselves in the valley of Rephaim. And when David inquired of the Lord, he said, thou shalt not go up, but fetch a compass behind them, which means make a detour and go to their rear without them seeing you, and assemble behind the Philistines, and come upon them over against the mulberry trees. The Hebrew simply says the weeping trees. I think the modern versions are probably more correct here, where they translate it balsam trees, the weeping effect of the balsam tree. But that's a minor detail. Verse 24, and let it be, when thou hearest the sound of a going in the tops of the mulberry trees or the balsam trees, that then thou shalt bestir thyself, for then shall the Lord go out before thee to smite the host of the Philistines. Listen carefully. Go right round the back of the Philistines, the other side of this small forest of trees. And listen carefully, because floating across the top of the trees, you'll hear the sound of the movement of the Philistines, the sound of a going in our version, which is better than the modern versions, who all decide on a little paraphrasing, and they say the sound of marching, the sound of a going. It's just the sound of movement, the sound, because the Philistines, something will disturb them. God will move, and you'll hear them on the move. You'll hear the sound of their equipment and their chariots, possibly, and everything else on the move. And once you hear that, you'll know that the Lord has gone before you, and he's already got them on the run and moving. The explanation is not given to us. And then thou shalt bestir thyself quickly, is the Hebrew. Go after them and smite them. And verse 25, David did so as the Lord had commanded him, and smote the Philistines, and they were routed and scattered. Well, just a closing remark or two. That has an application to us also. God has given us very detailed instructions in New Testament times about how we're to fight the spiritual warfare, and particularly the proclamation of the gospel and the winning of lost souls. David was told to take up an unorthodox position and a potentially highly disadvantageous one. And he obeyed God, and God moved, and we are too. We are called to trust entirely the power of prayer and witness and preaching of the gospel. Unfortunately today, so many people, they are constantly inventing methods of their own, ways of reaching the lost, all kinds of techniques, and using, as I constantly remind you, worldly techniques and means of attracting the people in. But we are given what might seem to be a disadvantageous approach. Witness and proclaim the gospel for all your worth, and depend upon prayer. Separate yourself from the world. Be a different people. Form working churches. Bestir yourselves. Get down to work. And those are the commands we obey. David had it all. Here it is. God would rout the Philistines by getting them on the move and on the run, then you must stir yourself and pursue them and deal with them and, as it were, finish them off. And it's the same for us. It's wrong to be a worldly church, devising things that the Lord hasn't ordained, using all the worldly methods and so on. It's equally wrong to be a dormant church, an inactive church, where most of the members have no avenue of service and take no part in the teaching of Sunday schools, the visiting of the community. That's equally wrong. The perfect balance is here. Follow the Lord's instructions, lock into them. It's his work, it's his plan, and bestir yourself and take your part and your role, everyone actively. So we see that balance in chapter after chapter, but that will be sufficient for us this evening as we reach that point at the end of chapter 5. Let's close our thinking, singing together.